I'm into something here that I cannot understand.
We are in the middle of a war, one that's been going on forever. Protect a secret so powerful that if revealed, it would devastate the very foundations of mankind.
What are you talking about?
You asked what would be worth killing for. Witness the biggest cover-up in human history.
Well, there's just a little taste of the Da Vinci Code. It looks like it could be a spine tingler, one of those that's going to have you on the edge of your seats when it hits the big screen here in about a week or so. We're going to be talking about the Da Vinci Code here in the first half hour of Issues, etc. First hour, really. We're going to hear a little bit from NPR and a piece that they've done on the Vatican vis-a-vis the Da Vinci Code. And then we're going to start a conversation with Dr. James Emery White of Gordon Conwell Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts, about the Da Vinci Code, taking its... Well, deciphering it, yes. Demythologizing it, yes. Debunking it, perhaps. And that's the first hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Our call-in numbers for this first hour and the remaining two, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. After our first hour's conversation, we'll be spending the second part with Dr. Gene Edward Veith on the importance of putting the focus on Jesus Christ. You listen to sermons? You read Christian books. You listen to Christian music. Not a lot of Jesus in there. Where is Christ in Christianity? We'll answer that question with Dr. Gene Edward Veith. At 4:30, we've got audio open lines, questions and comments from you. We've got a lot of things to play for you. The Vatican has at least indicated it's ready to say something new, something again. It's hard to tell about condom use. So we'll find out what the Vatican is going to be saying there. One of the topics we'll deal with during audio open lines. And then at 5:30, he's smart enough to be a doctor. Wesley Smith, our good friend and senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, will be our guest. We're going to talk about the right to die movement. I want to get some of his thoughts on some of my impressions that I got when we talked recently with the parents of Terry Schindler Schiavo. I want to get some of his thoughts on that in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. Email us here. We'll answer your questions and comments on the air. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called A Theology to Live By. There is nothing of the ivory tower in Reformation theology. It is a theology that is to be lived because it is sound scriptural theology. The book is called A Theology to Live By, the Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. Go to our website for more information. You'll find it there on our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. You've got 2 hours ahead to do so today, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. It's the Issues, Etc. book of the month for May. Well, here's a piece from National Public Radio. What they are covering, really, is the Vatican's varied reactions to the Da Vinci Code and the fervor that it is aimed squarely at the Roman Catholic Church. This is from National Public Radio.
When the Da Vinci Code was published in 2003, Catholic leaders were outraged by the novel's portrayal of the Church, and in particular, the religious organization Opus Dei. More than 40 million copies of the book have been sold, and the movie version is due to premiere later this month. Catholic officials are waging a campaign to debunk what they charge is a tendentious misrepresentation of history, and Opus Dei has asked Sony Pictures for a disclaimer at the start of the film, noting that it is a work of fiction. Sony has not responded to the request. NPR's Silvia Poggioli has more from Rome.
One of the basic premises of the Da Vinci Code is that for centuries the Catholic Church kept a dark secret, that Jesus married Mary Magdalene and had descendants. This is how the movie trailer lays it out.
Witness the biggest cover-up in human history.
An albino monk and Opus Dei member prays to Christ while lashing his bare back with a whip. these are among the most controversial points in the Da Vinci Code, a monk who commits murder and the depiction of Opus Dei as dangerous and power-hungry. In an effort to refute this portrayal and the novel's claims about the nature of Jesus and the role of women in the church, the U.S. Conference of Bishops, with the help of Opus Dei, has set up a website called Jesus Decoded that includes critical Catholic voices.
It's not meant to be history.
It was full of a great deal of silliness.
It's a novel, it's fiction, and it's entertainment.
I just took it for granted, of course, that people would say that this was just fiction.
Brian Finnerty, spokesman for Opus Dei in the United States, says the organization's basic strategy is to show that it is absolutely the opposite of how it's portrayed in the Da Vinci Code.
In reality, Opus Dei is an institution of the Catholic Church that helps people search for holiness in their work and everyday lives. There are no monks in Opus Dei, albino or otherwise.
The organized information campaign promoted by U.S. Catholic officials contrasts with the more alarmist tones coming from the church in Rome. Usually the Vatican ignores books or movies that paint the church in a controversial light, not this time. In his Good Friday sermon in St. Peter's Basilica, Father Raniero Cantalamessa, preacher to the papal household, took aim at what he called a pseudo-historic work, which he branded as another example of Jesus Christ being sold out. In the Pope's presence, he added, church leaders should not allow millions of people to be crassly manipulated by the media without raising a cry of protest. An even stronger attack on the book and movie was made by Archbishop Angelo Amato, the number two official in the Vatican's doctrinal office. Speaking to Catholic communication officials in Rome, he denounced the Da Vinci Code as obstinately anti-Christian and full of slander, offenses, and historical and theological errors regarding Jesus, the Gospels, and the Church.
Calunnie, offese, ed errori. Che se fossero stati indirizzati al Corano.
If such slanders, offenses, and errors had been directed at the Quran or the Holocaust, they would have justly provoked a world uprising. Instead, directed at the Church and Christians, they remain unpunished. I hope you will all boycott the movie.
The Vatican's alarmed reaction to a popular thriller has surprised many observers. Gian Enrico Rusconi, professor of political science at the University of Turin, says it betrays the Catholic Church's fear of losing control over the official interpretation of church history.
Scholars always knew there were other sources than the official Gospels. But now, ordinary people are aware that not everything they've been taught is necessarily true. And then there's the detail of Mary Magdalene, which raises the taboo of all taboos, sex and the role of women in the Catholic Church.
Dan Brown said recently that he hears from many women readers, including Catholic nuns, who say the novel has given them the strength to speak out on a forbidden topic, the marginalization of women in the Catholic Church. Sister Christine Schenck of the reformist Catholic movement Future Church says the Da Vinci Code has helped her group immensely.
Well, we had been working on Mary Magdalene, you know, straightening out the misconception that she was a prostitute and trying to help reappropriate her role as apostle to the apostles for over 7 years.
One person who has been analytically debunking the Da Vinci Code is Opus Dei priest John Walk. He even has a blog dedicated to correcting what he says are its historical and theological errors. He acknowledges he has some ambivalence. On the one hand, he says, the book's distortions are insulting to the faithful.
On the other hand, there is the phenomenon of the Da Vinci Code, which has raised all these questions and it really provoked a conversation. And in that conversation, I think a lot of good things can be said. As I say, the threat is not serious, and it's provoked an opportunity, really, to talk about things that really are important.
Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
That's the National Public Radio story on the general reaction from the time of the book all the way up here through the time of the film on the Da Vinci Code. There are some who are calling for a boycott. There are some who are saying, look, it's just a matter of distinguishing fact from fiction. And there are others who are genuinely worried. I think one of them expressed at least the opinion that people could be genuinely led astray from the Christian faith by something like this if they take it seriously. Now, haven't seen the film. I have seen probably all the trailers for The Da Vinci Code, and there's no doubt about it. it's going to be a compelling little romp through escapism. It will be great fiction. There's no doubt about it. And I think if you want to enjoy it as great fiction, then go and enjoy it as great fiction. But it raises some serious questions. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Dr. James Emery White to talk about The Da Vinci Code and the serious questions it raises. One of the biggest for me is this leap in logic that seems to be made by everyone who says, oh, there really are these, in the terms of the piece we just heard, other ancient sources other than the official Gospels. And they conclude that if they didn't know that these ancient sources existed, then someone must have been keeping it from them. You mean that there were other Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, or more lately, the Gospel of Judas? They really were these ancient documents? Well, no one ever told me this. Maybe they really have been covering it up. That's a leap. That's a logical leap that no one needs to make. No one really can legitimately make. Just because you didn't know something existed doesn't mean people were hiding it from you. And it hasn't been kept secret. These ancient documents, by the way, the church has been kind of on the forefront of studying and reviewing and looking at and taking seriously as ancient documents all of these things. Who do you think has been studying it? Now, of late, people like Elaine Pagels have been picking them up and saying, oh, no one's ever looked at these before, but that's just patently false. Lots of people have been looking at them. Drawing the conclusions that Elaine Pagels or Dan Brown or others make from them? Not necessarily. Those conclusions may be true, may be new, but that doesn't mean they're true. We're going to be talking about the Da Vinci Code. Our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Feel free to email us here with a question or a comment as we begin our conversation with Dr. James Emery White on the Da Vinci Code. A question you might have in advance of the film, a question you might have after having read the book, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 2727. In the second hour of the program, we'll talk about the importance of keeping the focus on Jesus Christ in everything Christians do. Dr. Gene Edward Veith of World Magazine will be our guest. By the way, he's taken a new position, and we're going to ask him about that when we get that conversation going with Dr. Gene Edward Veith. We'll have a little bit of audio open lines, and Wesley Smith will be our guest in the last half hour of Issues, Etc., to talk about the Right to Die movement. He's written something recently called Death by Ethics Committee. That's coming up in the last half hour. Dr. James Emery White is president of Gordon Conwell Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts. He's author of the new book titled, the booklet titled, The Da Vinci Question. Dr. White, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's deal with this one first, that just because we have recently, the general public has recently become aware that there are other ancient sources besides the official Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, things like that, that somehow means it's all been covered up all this time.
Oh, no, not at all. Most of these writings have been dated no earlier than the middle of the second century, many of them a lot later than that. The Gospel of Judas, which has received a lot of media hype of late, is dated at the earliest at around 300 A.D. These are removed by centuries from the actual life and ministry of Christ and the apostles, the formation of the church. They're not records or documents that shed light on the first century time of Jesus in any way whatsoever. Their claim to be authentic is accurate only in the sense that they might be authentically ancient. That's very different than authentically being, for example, the actual Gospel of Judas. They're almost universally recognized as forgeries. What happened was that many of these were discovered in Nag Hammadi in the 1940s, and they were not lost books or lost gospels of the Bible whatsoever. We just didn't find them in archaeological dig until then. But when they first came out, people knew about them. They were rejected as false documents even at the time. They're still rejected by the overwhelming majority of scholars as falsified Gnostic documents that were created to try and challenge the Christian faith. In fact, when the Gospel of Judas first came out as a writing, it was noted by such figures as Irenaeus and others as a production of Cainite Gnostics, which were a group that took it upon themselves to go back and take every reprehensible character they could find and paint them as good, which is why they were called Cainite Gnostics. They took their name from Cain, who committed the first murder. So taking it upon themselves to create a document that sought to rehabilitate Judas was par for the course.
there is there's a proposition put forth by the Da Vinci Code and other books that operate on a similar basis about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. What is that proposition? And then why is it that Mary Magdalene has garnered so much attention both lately and in the ancient world too?
Well, I think we as Christians can give her a lot of attention as well, and with great joy. I mean, she was a devoted follower of Christ and present at his crucifixion, his burial, first person Jesus appeared to following his resurrection. She was charged to bring the news to his disciples, which she did. She was a remarkable woman, prominently featured in the New Testament, honored throughout Christian history. But what Brown has one of his characters in the Da Vinci Code add to her story is that she was married to Jesus, and that the marriage of Mary Magdalene and Jesus is a matter of historical record. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. There's no historical record whatsoever to that effect, no evidence that indicates Mary had a relationship with Jesus beyond being a committed, devoted spiritual follower of his. In fact, Karen King, who is a history professor at Harvard and arguably the world's leading authority on Mary, says categorically there was never such a relationship between Mary and Jesus. He got the idea from a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which came out in 1982, one of the all-time classic examples of pop pseudo-history. Now, you may have heard that he took so much from that work, he was sued. He won the suit, but only because you can't copyright an idea. He freely admitted using the book as a source. And that all comes from French folklore. What really drives this idea, which you alluded to, is what Dan Brown has said himself on his website, which is that he has a desire to promote the idea of the sacred feminine. That's a code word. Translation is goddess worship. In fact, one of the characters in the book says that the quest for the Holy Grail is literally the quest to kneel before the bones of Mary Magdalene. And if you read the book, you know that that's how it ends, with the main character worshiping Mary Magdalene or experiencing her as a goddess.
So the premise here is that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, that they had children. The line exists today. The attempt to cover this up by the ancient church and by the modern church, they know what they're doing. They know what they're covering up. They're very good at it. But somehow the secret has been revealed.
Yes, and it is to be continued to be concealed until supposedly it's the right time to reveal it by this ancient society that includes people like Victor Hugo, Botticelli, Leonardo da Vinci, and then the book takes its name from the fact that da Vinci supposedly had all kinds of hidden clues and messages in his artwork to this effect, and specifically his painting of the Last Supper.
I want to come back to that painting of the Last Supper in a little bit, but people will say, well, one thing that's come to light with Dan Brown's novel and his kind of novel proposal about what Christianity really is and what it isn't is that there was an ancient document called the Gospel of Mary. Tell us about this.
Well, there was an ancient document called that. And as I mentioned earlier, it was a Gnostic document that began to be circulated during the mid-second century or later. The one that claimed to be the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the author writes in that, if you've read it, that Mary was loved by Jesus above all women, was a leader among the apostles, had alone been given secret knowledge by Jesus, and that Peter, the Apostle Peter, was threatened by her. Now, those writings, as I mentioned, have been dated no earlier than the middle of the second century, some even later than that, far removed from the actual life and ministry of Christ. So these were not alternate eyewitness reports that competed with the ones that ended up in the Bible. They appeared decades, even centuries later. The Gospel of Mary was actually found in Egypt. Showed up in a Cairo antiquities market in 1896. It was purchased later by a German scholar and then published in 1955. But people knew about it when it first came out, and it was rejected, along with such writings as the supposed Gospel of Thomas, as false documents, and still rejected by virtually all scholars today. The Gnostics were a group that arose during the early Christian centuries that wanted to claim secret knowledge that would challenge Orthodox Christianity. But what they said went against everything the early church stood for. For example, in the Gospel of Mary, it denies resurrection, argues against the second coming of Christ, rejects the suffering and death of Jesus as a path to eternal life. It even says there's no such thing as sin. Well, people knew that was not at all what Jesus said. So it was never taken seriously. And just because it surfaces today doesn't mean we should either, even though it dates back a few years. But that's not what Brown contends. He says that all four Gospels that we have in the Bible are wrong, and accounts such as the Gospel of Mary are true. But not a single scholar of note buys that, and neither does the textual historical evidence of their dating.
There seems to be a difference of opinion here, or at least a difference of opinion expressed, because when pressed upon it, Dan Brown seems to say, no, this isn't theory, and this isn't just some neat idea that I wish were true. He really does think it's true. The other people surrounding, especially the film, say, come on, it's a story, it's fiction, never meant to be taken seriously. So who do we listen to on this one?
Both, in a way. I mean, Dan Brown, I think, is very intent on trying to make the claims of his book be seen as true. He puts a prefatory page to that effect at the beginning of the book. Says that everything in here is based on fact and the way things really are. He alludes to it being essentially historical fiction. Now, people around the movie have got a huge public relations issue at hand because Christians have howled in protest, and rightfully so, since the release of the book. I mean, because there has seldom been such an outrageous set of assertions that are totally false and have no scholarship base whatsoever. Seldom has there been such a set of spurious things brought against historic Christianity. It puts forward this blend of fiction and historical assertion that suggests the entire foundation upon which Christianity is established is false. And it deserves to be evaluated vigorously and publicly, and Christians have been doing so, and the book has quite frankly been found severely wanting, and his lack of scholarship has been brought forward. But it's popular, sold a lot of books, so the movie comes out, and so they're wanting to downplay some of the protests by saying, well, it is just a fun tale, don't take it too seriously. So you've got a bit of a PR spin happening on that end of things.
Before we go to this break, with less than a minute, the book has sold like hotcakes. The film will probably be a runaway success. Do you think the success of the book and then the film are due to the claims made in it, that they have some sort of resonance with people, or is it just a page-turner?
Yes. Again, yes. It is a good beach read, as we used to say. It's a page-turner. It's well-written in a John Grisham-like way. But I do think that people are always attracted to conspiracy theories and secrets, and you throw in Jesus and Da Vinci and children, and it just hits a chord of interest, even if people don't buy it.
Dr. James Emery White is president of Gordon Conwell Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts, author of the new book titled The Da Vinci Question. When we come back, we'll continue with some of those questions, your questions and comments as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issues@kfuo.org. We'll give a copy of this book a little way to the best callers with questions or comments. 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. When we come back, we'll turn to the art of Leonardo da Vinci. It really plays a big part, especially, I think, in the film, when you have the depiction of this art as something other than it really is. People actually can look at it. I've seen the painting. And yeah, it's hard to tell who's sitting next to who and who is who sometimes, but Dan Brown's claims go far beyond just, it's unclear who's sitting next to Jesus. He thinks he knows. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The reformer Martin Luther and his theology have been understood and misunderstood for almost 500 years. Was Luther's theology merely warmed over Roman Catholicism? Was Luther a Protestant? How important were the ideas of sin, grace, and the justification of the sinner to Luther's thought, theology, and Reformation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, A Theology to Live By, right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for A Theology to Live By.
What happened to the momentum for the pro-abortion forces coming out of the Year of the Woman in 1992? This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
10 years ago, Congress was on the brink of passing the Freedom of Choice Act. Today, state after state is passing more restrictions on abortions. Some say the watershed moment for pro-life forces was the introduction of the partial birth abortion ban. Another contributing factor was the improvement of medical technology, such as 4D ultrasounds. Regardless of why, the pro-life trend is good news. Even Hillary Clinton now talks more about making abortion rare than protecting the so-called right of abortion on demand.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I composed this minute while sitting in a meeting. Most of you know how to pull this off, how to be in a meeting, but have your mind on other things. You get yourself a seat in the back. Get your papers out and get to your work. But every now and then, do something to give the impression that you are engaged in the meeting. Most of us are experienced at multitasking. We have all done the religious version during boring Sunday sermons, looking engaged, but planning out the week, paying the bills, and the like. Oh, just a second. Okay, I'm back. The speaker was looking at me, and I had to look back, had to look like I'm really into it. Multitasking is a way to get a lot of work done, but it's addictive and not always good. I find that it makes it hard to keep my mind focused during prayer. Prayer is like a meeting. Our Father who art in heaven, you say, and the meeting is then opened, you and your God, but the prayer goes on, and your mind inevitably goes off to other things. When the meeting adjourns, amen, you haven't accomplished the purpose of the meeting, an intimate, renewing time with your Father and your Savior. So, whose loss is that? You know what? When you begin to pray, the meeting has begun. And hey, he's looking your way.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code. Dr. James Emery White is our guest. Now, the listeners with the best questions and comments will get Dr. White's new booklet called The Da Vinci Question, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address. You don't have to be a caller. You can also be an emailer, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're coming to you live this Wednesday. It is the 10th of May, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we get to the art itself that really kind of forms the central claim of the Da Vinci Code, the code itself, one of the tenets here is that there's been this vast cover-up, and someone might object to everything that you said in the last segment, Dr. White, by simply asserting, look, the fact that we have so little evidence for these things being true is only evidence of how good and thorough and well, this thing has been covered up.
You could say that if you wanted to. That would be a bit disingenuous, and I'll tell you why. Because it's not simply the lack of evidence, and people say, well, there you have the cover-up, because that could be an argument, therefore, for anything. That doesn't prove anything. I think that what is the larger issue is the evidence that we have contradicting the idea, and that's critical. There is an enormous amount of evidence, historical evidence, that disproves categorically the things that he says in the book and the cover-up and the idea of the alternate scriptures and those kinds of things. Let me see if I can give an analogy for the kind of evidence that is out there. Let's say I wrote a book about the 2006 Super Bowl. But instead of writing that the Pittsburgh Steelers defeated the Seattle Seahawks, let's imagine that I claim that the Carolina Panthers stormed their way to the big game and beat the Steelers 34-3 the way God intended. And in my book, let's say that I cite all kinds of statistics, play-by-play analysis, and then I self-publish it as an actual record of what took place. Now, what would happen? Would anybody buy it, unless it's a joke book for a Panther fan? Would anybody really believe it? Well, no. If intended to be a credible account of Super Bowl 40, it'd be laughed off the stands. And the reason is because an estimated 140-plus million people watched the game in the U.S. alone. Now, that's why the early Gospels on the life and teaching and ministry of Jesus, written by those who are eyewitnesses to his life and teaching, took hold. When the accounts written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John came out as early as 25 to 50 years after the time of Christ, and we know that they came out that early, such as, for example, the Magdalen Papyrus, people were still around who knew whether what they purported to have happened did or did not occur, and they were not left out of the bookstores. Now, not so with the Gnostic writings that came out decades later. They were never suppressed. They were ridiculed. And just because we uncover one or more of them today, like when we discovered a batch of them in 1945, doesn't mean that they had any weight back then. They didn't. Or even think of it this way. Think of it, what would have happened if 1,000 years from now somebody finds one of these documents that came out after World War II that denies the Holocaust took place? They would have been authentic to this era, meaning ancient, but they would have been anything but accurate or authoritative as history.
Regarding the art of Leonardo da Vinci, there's been, pardon the pun, a bit of a renaissance and interest in what he was trying to convey in his art. Dan Brown's contention is that this famous mural of the Last Supper is a coded message to the ages of what Christianity really is and what it isn't. What does he say is going on in this famous painting?
He claims that it is a sign that Mary Magdalene and Jesus were in a relationship, that she was the Holy Grail because she carried his child, and that the painting of the Last Supper, because it does not have a chalice, and the person to Jesus' right is very feminine-looking and is not John the Baptist, but is Mary, and it's one of many of the codes, but perhaps the main code, about the secret of Jesus and Mary. Now, when you've looked at the painting, there's no doubt the person does look feminine. The person to the right of Jesus in Da Vinci's Last Supper does look feminine. But this is where Brown didn't do his homework. There's some common understandings about art history that, quite frankly, surprised me that he didn't dig a little bit deeper to discover. At first, it was very common for artists of that day to portray John as young, fair, and always clean-shaven. In fact, when you examine paintings of the Apostle John during the Renaissance, you see that representation over and over and over again. Second, Da Vinci, more than most, had a tendency to portray young men in a feminine way in all of his paintings. Now, whether that was due to his supposed homosexuality or not, we don't know, but in almost all of his paintings, he portrayed young men in a feminine way. So to jump and claim that this is a woman, and Mary Magdalene at that, has led art historian after art historian to call the claim to the book ludicrous. They say not only is it not Mary Magdalene, but could never have been intended as such. And if there's any doubt that that was Leonardo's intent, we know what his intent was because we have the existence of preliminary sketches for the Last Supper. They're actually now in Venice, which Leonardo made of each apostle in the painting. And not only did he make sketches of each one, he labeled them. And he labeled this John, not Mary. And these were his private, personal sketches. Brown also, as I said, makes a lot of the fact that there's no chalice in the picture because he claims Leonardo wanted Mary to be seen as the Holy Grail. Well, not only wasn't it Mary, but art historians have also pointed out that Da Vinci wasn't painting the moment where the bread and the wine were being passed. The scene was specifically meant to capture not the institution of the Eucharist or communion, which would have featured the chalice, but the earlier moment, when Jesus says that one of the apostles will betray him. And that's why you've got the emotional displays and all the apostles' faces, and including that of Judas, which is, for this reason, painted in shadow. So to read any other meaning into this painting is considered by art historians to be, quite frankly, ridiculous.
What about the claim that Da Vinci, along with other luminaries of the time and in the surrounding history, was in fact a member of a secret society who kept the secret and in many ways were guardians of this thing that simply waiting for the right time to reveal
right.
it.
Right. Well, the documents Brown mentions as being discovered in Paris in the 1970s at the front of his book, attesting to the group, is considered by almost all people who are familiar with it to have been planted there and forged to boot. In fact, the hoax was revealed in a 1996 BBC documentary, one that Brown apparently didn't see.
So this Priory of Zion that is supposed to have existed from the very beginnings of Christianity, fighting to keep the secret, isn't the real hoax is the Priory of Zion.
Yep.
Well, at the heart of this is the troubling assertion on Brown's part and those who agree with his theory, either in whole or in part, that Jesus is not the one portrayed in the biblical Gospels, that he is, in fact, just a man, and that he is, in fact, really probably more a worshiper of Mary Magdalene than Mary Magdalene was a worshiper of him.
Mm.
How do we deal with that?
Well, I think that along the lines that I had mentioned earlier about the absolute integrity and trustworthiness of the four independent accounts that we do have of the life and teaching of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, that are in the Bible, not because they were invented for it or just chosen arbitrarily out of some supposed 80 other alternate accounts, which Brown asserts, but nobody knows what 80 he's talking about. They don't exist. But it even goes further in the sense that historically we know exactly what was said about the life and teaching of Jesus, and it's been completely and thoroughly authenticated and documented. And his claim that all of this was just invented in the Council of Nicaea, for example, in 325, is really, really interesting. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen revisionist history quite this bold and based on spurious assertions. For example, he says that everybody thought like Arius, everybody, that narrowly passed this Nicene Creed that said Jesus was divine and so forth, narrowly passed. I think the vote was 298-2, if my memory serves. That's not a narrow passing. One of the things that's frustrating about this book, when I first read it, is that page after page after page makes these outrageous claims, says it as absolute fact, as if everybody knows it, and this is where scholarship lands, and it's nothing of the sort.
One of the frustrating things about it, Dr. White, is that Dan Brown in the book claims these things are fact. Now, at one point, he might have been able to say, look, I'm bringing the reader into a world of fantasy. What if? And so I'll make these claims of fact because I'm trying to draw them into that world. But he's gone beyond that.
He has.
And publicly said that the only fictional part of the book really are the characters with which he constructs the drama surrounding the cover-up. But he says the rest of it is all true.
Yes, he does, and he says that everything that you read in the book, based on actual documents, secret societies, everything described in rituals, and everything related to archaeology and architecture, I should say, he says it's all based on facts. So he is essentially saying, I have just built a story around the facts, and he really does claim that it is almost a form of historical fiction, and he makes many, many claims in it. And, I mean, even the small ones are often wrong. Like he has in there that he claims great symbolic significance to the glass pyramid in front of the Louvre having 666 panes of glass. It doesn't have 666 panes. The Louvre went out and counted. There are 673. I mean, even the smallest of details that he tries to read great significance in are not accurate.
We're talking about the Da Vinci Code with Dr. James Emery White of Gordon Conwell Seminary in Southampton, Massachusetts. He's author of the booklet, The Da Vinci Question. Best callers and emailers will get a copy of this booklet. Our in-studio email address issues etc@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Here's Jeff. He's calling from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, listening on the Internet. Hi, Jeff.
Hey. Very often it's very hard to know how to respond to this because it is kind of so silly in one respect or so ahistorical. By responding, you don't want to give it credence. But if you don't respond, it's kind of the parallel passages, answer a fool according to his folly or lest he be wise in his own eyes. Personally, you don't want to sound like it seems like a lot of people want their cyanide coated with sugar, and it's in a nice story. And since it was, they so readily believe a lie, it kind of shows that they didn't really love the truth in the first place. And it seems, you know, there's so many, there's since it has such a wide spread of people it's reached, there's a lot of different groups and a lot of different people. You know, some people are saying, well, why are you responding to this? It's fiction to begin with, so that must mean that you're not, you know, there must be something deficient with our truth claims, and then some people who believe it, and then it's just kind of a, it's a big mess.
A couple things there, Jeff. Thank you very much for the call. First of all, the fact that many people do believe it, Jeff says, perhaps may be indicative of their lack of grounding or their lack of knowledge or perhaps even their lack of affection for the truth in the first place. Your thoughts, Dr. White?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how many Christians were sitting around talking about the Council of Nicaea prior to this? I mean, I think that this has revealed that a lot of pastors and teachers and Christians were kind of caught flat-footed because they knew the claims were wrong, but they didn't know why and didn't know quite know how to respond. And so I think it's been a good exercise for us to do a little bit of historical work and research on the integrity of Scripture and history and be able to ground ourselves in a biblical worldview and a Christian mind and maybe dust off some good apologetics, which we are called to do. 1 Peter says, be prepared to give to every man an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within you. I think that the reason that this one we have dignified with a response is because it wasn't just something laughably fictitious. It was something put forward as fact. And then it received such broad, wide cultural significance. I think that if we had been silent, we would have added to its credibility. And, in fact, I had one newspaper reporter ask me, you know, why are Christians getting so exercised about this? I mean, it's almost like you guys are defensive. And I just said, listen, friend, if we were silent, it would have made it seem like we had no answer. And then if we answer, we are sounding defensive. You're putting us in a no-win.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't.
That's right. And quite frankly, if Christianity is true, it'll stand up under any amount of intellectual and historical scrutiny. And if this is going, if the gospel of Jesus, the gospel of the Bible, and the life of Jesus is going to be put out into the marketplace for debate, if Christians are not there robustly and rigorously engaging that debate, shame on us.
Well, the irony here, Dr. White, is that there are many Christians who, having been forced to the question by the popularity of the book and then the film, who were actually for the very first time even taking a glance at their own history.
Yes.
At the Council of, you mentioned this before, the Council of Nicaea, the development of the church's canon, you know, the recognition of the canon. What did early Christians do with false writings? What has the church done with these false writings? These questions are for the very first time coming before Christians.
One of the things that is so interesting to me is that there are certain aspects of thought that never go away. And when Christians fail to remember our history and previous heresies, we simply let them back into the public discourse and even in the church. Great example is Arius and that controversy, as well as Gnosticism and pagan goddess worship, all of those things.
Okay, so do Christians have a responsibility to read the Da Vinci Code?
Great question, and that's an area of huge debate right now. I'll tell you my spin on it, and there's going to be a lot of people who might disagree. I think we're called to be salt and light, and that means cultural engagement, period. We can have dialogue as to how to do that, but the question of whether we should, I think, is without debate for those who claim to be biblical Christians. People who say that if you engage secular culture, you're just like embracing a piece of rotten meat, and you just can't help but come away smelling bad yourself, and why would you want to go see a movie that blasphemes Christ? You know, that's not the way to reach out to people. I think, quite frankly, I disagree. I think in Christ's day, salt was used as a preservative to ensure that meat did not go bad. You can't fault meat for going bad. It's what meat does. Question is, where's the salt? We're charged to prevent moral decay in our culture. That was the metaphor that Christ used and what his intent was. Now, going to see a movie may not be the answer to reaching people, but if a movie is the reason people are questioning Christ or raising questions about Christ, it may very well be the key to reaching them. So, should Christians see the film? I think many should. if their mind and soul is prepared, else it will be difficult to speak to the questions it will raise. There will be water cooler conversations following May 19th. Christians should be present and accounted for. We don't need to defend God, but we do need to engage the world. And this is why I will have a ticket in hand. Maybe not on May 19th. I'm somewhat convinced by the argument that giving the film a big opening weekend might encourage the making of some other Da Vinci knockoff, but I will eventually see it. Now, I don't think this is similar to whether we should fill our minds with sordid images such as might be found in Brokeback Mountain. But instead, I think this is about engaging the ideas that I know will be presented to hearts and minds about the gospel itself. And I am called to be prepared to give an answer, but that will mean first knowing the question. So for me, I actually think the film is important to see.
Whom would you caution, if anyone, not to see this film?
Obviously, I would not caution anyone who is going to go in there with any illusions about how weak its foundation is. I do, if somebody were to say, well, do you recommend a spiritual seeker to see it? Well, you know, it depends on if I have a relationship with them. If I have a spiritual friend, a friend who's a spiritual seeker, they're probably going to want to see it, and I'm probably going to go with them and then take them out to Starbucks afterward, and then we'll have a good conversation and let it raise the kinds of issues that are important to be raised. I guess that I'm such an old-fashioned evangelist that I look at something like this as opportunity more than anything else. I mean, when is the last time these kinds of issues were such a part of cultural debate and cultural discourse? This is a wonderful moment in a perverse kind of way through something that was intended to challenge the gospel, and it's given church leaders an opportunity to talk about the gospel more than anything in recent memory.
The world is listening. I mean, there's no doubt about it that when something catches the ear of the world in this way, and by kind of overhearing it, the church as well, there is an opportunity. I think they are waiting for us to give a response. Whether they're going to take it seriously or not, they are waiting for us to give a response.
Yeah, and what is so helpful is that mainstream scholarship, I mean, scholars who would not consider themselves Christians are saying, well, you know, they're right. This is bogus. This is not accurate. This is sloppy scholarship. That isn't good history. That is not, we don't have any evidence for that claim. And so it is helping us as a result.
So how would you classify the book itself? You said that Dan Brown presents it almost as historical fiction. Mm-hmm. That is, true history with fictitious characters set in it for the sake of the story. How would you classify the novel?
Diabolical and devious in its way it subtly undermines Christianity and makes you believe that it's based on fact. It is a very seductive novel in that sense. But in terms of just typecasting it, I mean, yes, it's fiction, but it is a unique blend where he is saying through that prefatory page, everything you're about to read is based on fact. And that makes it a very different kind of book and really attempting to be some type of historical fiction.
And then someone says, look, now I can go to the bookstore, whoever thought this would happen, and pick up a copy of the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Thomas, or whatever's left of these ancient documents. I can go, if I really want to shell out the money and get the whole Nag Hammadi library and read all the pseudepigrapha I want. How should a Christian approach those documents that have already been sent up and down the flagpole of the church and found wanting? How should they approach those?
Well, again, I think that if you're going to be engaging the cultural debate and conversation, and you're talking to someone who's not a Christian who asks you, well, what do you think about the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Mary, you should at least have some knowledge of why the church does not accept them, why they're not in our canon, maybe a basic contour of what they say. You don't necessarily have to read them yourself, although I certainly think it won't do you any harm to know what's in there, because you need to kind of know what the debate is, what they're claiming, and realize how completely out of sorts it is with Christianity.
Quick phone call here from Ann in Crestwood. Hi, Ann. Our time is short.
Hi. I know. What is it that in his background that makes him go in this direction? I mean, he really wants this to be true, it sounds like, and that's my question.
Okay. Can you answer that question, Dr. White, about Dan Brown, the author of the novel?
Well, obviously not with firsthand knowledge, but I think it's fairly well known that his wife has written several books on New Age thinking about goddesses and channeling spirit guides and things of that nature. I think her name was Sylvia Brown, my memory serves. So there's that connection. There's also a sense where he himself does embrace the idea of the sacred feminine and seems to be personally promoting or sympathetic to goddess worship of some type. And so I think that is certainly behind his own personal intents on this, although obviously I cannot speak firsthand.
You can't sell as many books as Dan Brown has sold, Dr. White, without being asked by the publisher to write another one. So if you're going to take an educated guess, what do you think his next novel is going to be about? You could hardly top the claims of this one, but where do you think he goes next?
Well, you know, his writings prior to this, such as Angels and Demons, and there was one other work that he wrote, all were about the same kinds of things, undermining Christianity, dealing with spiritual issues, taking Christianity or Catholicism to task. And I would think that we're going to have more of the same, conspiracy theories. I think he's going to do a little bit better work on his scholarship. He has delayed the next book quite a bit, and I think one of the reasons rumored around is because his last book was taken to task so much in terms of what he claimed to be true. But I think we'd expect more of the same.
Well, before we let you go, give our best, if you would, to Dr. David Wells. He's a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. We have a great admiration for his work there at Gordon Conwell and for the rest of the faculty, Dr. White.
I certainly will.
Dr. James Emery White is president of Gordon Conwell Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts, author of the booklet titled The Da Vinci Question. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be turning our attention to the importance of keeping Christ in Christianity. If you can do Christianity without Christ, you're not talking about Christianity anymore. Oh, by the way, Ann and Jeff, give us a call back. We'll send you a copy of this booklet, The Da Vinci Question, by our guest, Dr. James Emery White. So, Dr. Gene Edward Veith will be our guest. Why is it that you can hear sermon after sermon after sermon? You can sometimes go weeks, months, maybe even years in some churches. They call themselves Christian, call themselves evangelical, with nary a mention of Jesus. Maybe if he is mentioned, he is moral example. Something along those lines. You can go to Christian bookstores, and peruse the books from one end to the other on every subject imaginable, and even in books that claim to be Christ-centered, you find very little Christ. It goes for Christian music and all sorts of other things that Christians partake of all the time. We're going to talk when we come back with Dr. Gene Edward Veith of World Magazine about the importance of putting and keeping the focus on Jesus Christ.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.